Welcome into AWA Unleashed. We are the preeminent American Wrestling Association podcast and video. Want to get the video out there, hence how you're looking at me here. My name is Chris Tubbs, but I am not the one you want to hear from because I'm just a guy. I'm the guy that pushes the buttons. I'm not the one that has the goods. That being said, let's bring in George Shire and Mick Karch. And guys, here we go again. I know that today's it's kind of a fun one because we've covered several topics, but ultimately this is about fans. This is about people wanting to hear what you guys have to say, and people have questions. So today it is a no DQ and A, which is all about listener submitted questions. But before we get to that, I want to ask you guys, feedback continues to be very positive, not to put ourselves over, because always willing to listen to any criticism, you know, negative, even if it's there. But I got to admit, I'm having a good time, and it seems like people so far, guys, are really enjoying what we're doing.
Absolutely positive response. And like you said, we want to hear if you think there's something we're doing wrong or that sort of thing. But we've had absolutely positive feedback. Everybody is telling us they're enjoying the show, enjoying what we're doing, that they're laughing. They're learning the inside, the little stories. We're going to keep it up. We're going to do a lot of shows on a lot of wrestlers, and it's going to get only better. We'll just keep telling you the main event is still coming.
What I would say is, for us old school guys, it's so gratifying to hear and see how many people miss the AWA, how many remember the AWA, you know, in this day and age of sports entertainment. We're still out there. It took a while to get the podcast going where we're talking about those memories, but here we are.
Yeah. Before we get going into the questions here, let's go ahead and revisit last week's trivia question, Mick, because it was all about Bobby Heenan. And tell us the question again, and then also tell us the answer.
The question was, who was the last wrestler that Bobby Heenan managed in the AWA before he went to the WWF? A lot of people said Mr. Saito. Probably the overwhelming number said Mr. Saito. But in actuality, and I think George could probably touch on this too, it was Harley Race. Harley Race was the last man managed by Bobby Heenan. And congratulations, Eric Martin, on winning this week's trivia.
And George, I know that to go along with that, there's a certain point that I think you purposely, you intentionally left that out because you didn't want to kind of give a little bit of a teaser as to what that answer might be.
Well, you will remember when I did the introduction as to when Bobby the Brain Heenan came to the AWA for the first time. And I purposely left off the name Harley Race as being the guy he managed first in 1967. Now you're going to say, well, he did this purposely. Well, you know, I was testing you because wrestling fans always remember things that promoters don't want them to remember. And when Bobby Heenan came here in 1969 with Blackjack Lanza, the promoters never acknowledged that he had been here 2 years earlier for it. Pretty much a coffee break, if you want to call it that. But he did manage Harley Race from October to December of 1967. And Chris, I had shared with you a program that mm-hmm. shows him going against Vern Gagne. And Bobby Heenan is mentioned in that program story. And he wrestled Vern with his manager at ringside. But he was gone right after that and never mentioned again. But I had two fans, Sean Finnegan and Roger Buck, two of our most loyal supporters and two very good old school fans.
And there it is right there, George. Here's the I think that's the program that you had sent me.
And if anybody were to look at it, it's right in there in the middle, the second, third paragraph where it mentions his manager, Bobby Heenan. And that was from December of 1967. So he was here. Roger Buck and Sean Finnegan, they took me to task and said, you left him out. Are we going? Are we losing our minds? And I said, no, guys, you are right, and I will explain it. But I didn't deliberately leave him off on purpose. Mm-hmm. I did want to just not lead up to him being the last man to be managed by Bobby Heenan. So Bobby did full circle. He came in with Harley Race, and he exited
with Harley. Yeah. And again, congratulations going out to Eric Martin. We're going to have some trivia a little bit later on. Again, let's go ahead and get to it, guys. We got a lot of listener questions here. The first one, and this is for you, George, from Jeff Sharkey. When did the AWA change from alliance to association?
That's interesting, you know, and that's something that I've discussed on our wrestling pages, and I was kind of surprised when Jeff sent it to me in a private message. But the answer is, as close as we can get it, was around 1970. But here's what happened. It was American Wrestling Alliance for the first 10 years in programs and on TV. And around 1970, all of a sudden, it was association. And I had a talk with Vern Gagne one time in the early 80s. And I asked him, when did it change or how did it change? And he told me it never did. He said it was always association. But the fact is, it wasn't. In the programs and in their articles of incorporation papers, which I have copies of for the AWA, it was the American Wrestling Alliance. So around 1970, with no fanfare at all.
So kind of to piggyback off of that then, a follow-up. Why did the AWA, why did those tag team belts, the one that were worn by the Road Warriors, say alliance instead of association?
Wow. When the Road Warriors won the AWA tag team title, they originally had the original AWA belts. Vern had new belts made for the Road Warriors, and he did what he usually did. He contacted his old buddy, Reggie Parks, in Omaha. Reggie was one of the great belt makers, and it's a little bit hard to see, but it does say Alliance on the belts that you're seeing on your screen right now. And what happened was, is Vern never told Reggie that it had changed to association, and Reggie went off of his great memory. He had worked for the AWA, and he made two belts with Alliance, and Vern got mad at him because he said it was always association. So it wasn't Reggie's fault. Reggie did what he was, but then Vern wasn't going to spring for two new belts. So the Road Warriors had American Wrestling Alliance, and that's how it happened.
Why is it the wrestling business that you can't communicate? Why is the communication, guys, in the wrestling business, why is it so bad? Like, why is there just gaps in logic when it comes to this? That's kind of just off the cuff.
What are you talking about? Gaps in logic in professional wrestling?
I know, right?
Are you kidding?
Maybe I'm watching a different product, guys. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe I remember things differently.
Wrestling and logic in the same sentence does not work.
No, it doesn't.
Hey, let's get to one for you here, Mick, from Len McElroy. Do you think Bruiser, and I've gotten a lot of Bruiser Brody questions, guys, and you know, maybe we'll kind of revisit it or, you know, dive into it a little bit more down the road. But from Len McElroy, do you think Bruiser Brody would have made a good AWA champion considering his notoriety?
Absolutely not. First of all, Bruiser Brody did not need the AWA championship. He didn't need any belt, really. I mean, he was enough of an attraction on his own. But I think the lesson of Stan Hansen, you could probably apply to Bruiser Brody. Yeah, he had the notoriety. There he is. There's our old pal, Frank. He had the notoriety, but he also had the reputation of being his own man, his own rebel. And he basically could not be trusted in a lot of situations. If he didn't like the finish of a match, for example, he changed the finish in the middle of the match. I saw him in a match with Jerry Blackwell, and he walked out of the ring. He left. He didn't like the finish. So in retrospect, would he have made a good AWA champion? Absolutely not. Vern needed somebody on top that he could trust like a Nick Bockwinkel.
You know, I would just say that the idea that a lot of fans have, they want so-and-so to be champion or so-and-so should have had a run with the belt. That's very common. And they often forget that many wrestlers, Brody among them, did not need a title to be over. And therefore, it didn't make sense.
Just going to unmute my microphone there while I'm switching all these pictures around. Got another one here for you, George. I'm going to go back up. From Scott Tomasino, hopefully I'm pronouncing your name there, Scott. Scott Tomasino, going back to Harley Race, because he kind of started, you know, you talked about Harley and Heenan. He read that Harley Race was stabbed in a Minneapolis bar. What was the story to that?
That is a very true story. Larry Hennig and Harley Race had just won the AWA tag team title in January of 65 and at the end of the month. And in the month of February, Harley Race, along with fellow wrestlers Rene Goulet, Eddie Sharkey, and probably some others, they were at a bar, the Chestnut Tree, in downtown Minneapolis. And during their time there, there were three guys that were kind of beating up on a lady in the bar. And the owner of the bar asked Harley to kind of step forward. Harley did. Harley took down two of the guys. But the third one got him with a knife in his back, and Harley was out of action. This actually made the newspapers, the Minneapolis and St. Paul newspapers, that Harley Race was a hero. And he was out of action for about 3 weeks. The knife supposedly had come very close to his heart. He was out of action about 2-3 weeks. And during that time, Larry Hennig, their commitments were filled. Larry Hennig had a partner that was working with him, title not on the line, of course. But the very great story about this, when Harley came back to action on the TV studio match, they introduced Larry Pretty Boy Hennig. Then they introduced Handsome Harley Race. And every fan in the TV studio gave him a standing ovation. But that wasn't what Harley wanted, because he was a heel. So he started the match, immediately started kicking the ever-loving stuffing out of his opponent, and in about 30 seconds, every fan in that arena was booing Harley Race, and to me, that was the genius of Harley. But the injury was very serious, and Eddie Sharkey and both Rene Goulet also told that story many times.
Was there, I mean, back in those days, because I know today we have all this information at our fingertips, how did fans like find out about, you know, things like that? Was that, did fans kind of cross over into appreciating and respecting the toughness of Harley Race at that point? Is that why they gave him that standing ovation and they were cheering him, even though he's supposed to be the heel?
The fact that it was in the morning papers.
News, okay.
You know, I mean, obviously even wrestling fans, I assume some of them could read. Oh, but anyway, the wrestling show, All-Star Wrestling, they did acknowledge that Harley Race was out of action, that he had come to the rescue of a patron, a lady. And, you know, they played him up as being somebody that came forward, and that was good. But the important thing was, is when he came back, he had to have that heat back. And Harley knew how to do it. And after that, it was never discussed. From that day forward, when he got his booze back, that injury here in the AWA was never, ever acknowledged. However, anybody that ever saw Harley Race in any match afterwards, you could see the moon-shaped scar on his back where he had it. It was near the rib cage there, at the upper rib cage.
All right, I got a question for you here, Mick, from Brian Huff, kind of because, you know, we're talking about violence. What was the story about Eddie Sharkey firing a gun at the old AWA office?
That's absolutely true, and and Eddie tells the story proudly. I'm not speaking out of turn here. Eddie always stood up for the people in the business, and he had a beef with Vern, and this is going back to the middle 1960s. So one particular afternoon or evening, I don't know when it was, Eddie went down to the Dyckman Hotel to the wrestling office at 605 Dyckman Hotel. Thank God nobody was in the office at the time. And Eddie had a pistol with him, and he proceeded to, you know, shoot through the window and shoot the walls of the wrestling office. And as a matter of fact, the story goes that they had a full-size cutout of Vern there in the wrestling office, and Eddie hit that one square between the eyes. Very proud of that. And there were no charges filed. Somebody very close to Eddie Sharkey said that Vern and Wally both told him, or told the person, get this message to Eddie Sharkey, not to have his henchmen come up to the wrestling office firing a gun anymore. Well, they knew that it wasn't a henchman, it was Eddie Sharkey. And Eddie proudly tells that story, and it's a badge of honor for him. Just real quick, another Eddie Sharkey, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Had a little beef with a promoter in Wisconsin years ago and didn't like the payoff some of the boys were getting. So Eddie took an empty beer bottle to the promoter's noggin. Boom, knocked him cold. Well, the promoter, of course, takes Eddie Sharkey to court. And as part of his defense, Eddie is going to show the judge that the beer bottle, an empty beer bottle, is easily breakable, does no damage. Boom, yeah. Boom, boom. He hits himself on the head about 3-4 times. The bottle's not breaking. And Sharkey, on the other hand, is on concussion protocol. And I believe Eddie wound up paying a fine for the whole bottle. But you got to love Eddie. Any Eddie Sharkey story that you've heard is true.
I just want to add that when he went up to the wrestling office and did his little practice shooting, I'm only thankful that Joe Scarpello wasn't up there laying on the cot, because Joe Scarpello slept up there all the time in the wrestling office, and God help him, he wasn't there that night.
Oh, my God. Well, hopefully we can get into like an Eddie Sharkey episode down the road, because I'm sure they're just a ton of meat on that bone. And I know that's one thing that people have been bringing up to us. Another one for you here, George, from Jay Barnett. Why did Dr. Bill Miller come to the AWA with a mask? And also, why did Vern put the title on him?
Well, first of all, about the mask, that was one of the greatest gimmicks of the kayfabe era. And most territories at any time in their runs had a masked man or several masked men. But Vern and Dr. Bill Miller were very good friends outside the ring. And they had met each other many times in the 50s. So when the AWA was started, Vern decided to bring in a monster heel, and there's a picture of him there. That was a bright red cape with a red mask and a white M, and he was 6'100" tall. I mean, he was a monster. So it really worked well, the mysterious Mr. M. And Vern put the title on him. Basically, it was as a favor to his friend, and it also built up a tremendous feud, and Bill Miller held the title for about 8 months. And then when his run in the AWA was over, he did the honors. He took the mask off, but Vern took it off of him in a match that Vern won the title back. But it was to draw fans, to draw some intrigue to the promotion. And literally in those days, nobody had a way of finding out who Big Bill Miller even was. But that's who it was.
Mick, I want to ask, we're kind of off the cuff here. What is the story? Because you guys referred to it last week after we got done with the Heenan episode. What's the deal with Bobby Heenan in the airport? I feel like this is something that people would want to hear. Because it made me giggle, and I'm like, that's the kind of thing that people need.
Well, and it's classic Bobby Heenan. This is at O'Hare Airport in Chicago. And I believe this is back in the 1980s. And there were a group of Japanese wrestling fans, tourists, at the airport waiting for their flight back. And Bobby and Nick Bockwinkel are in the airport. And this group of tourists apparently wants to get their picture taken with Nick. So that, you know, Bobby volunteers. Bobby Heenan volunteered to be the photographer for this photo session. So the Japanese tourists, God bless them, they're all surrounding Nick Bockwinkel, and they're giving the thumbs up, and they're smiling and everything else. And Bobby's clicking away, boom, boom, boom. They leave, and Nick says, what the hell got into you? You know, why are you Mr. Nice Guy all of a sudden willing to take pictures of people? And Bobby said, bullshit. I deliberately cut off their heads in every picture. So that was... Typical Bobby Heenan. Yeah, he wasn't going to be a nice guy for anybody.
I mean, you guys were telling me that story last week when we got done, and I just thought, I mean, I lost my shit. I thought it was just
hilarious. Can you imagine these poor people get off the plane and they pictures develop? They're all excited, and every one of them looks like the Headless Horseman. I mean, classic.
Well, and the fact that Bobby got his rocks off doing things like that, he never got to see the reaction of them, but in his mind, I know he got his giggle.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, man. Oh, that's absolutely great. Today, you guys, if you haven't caught on, it's a no DQ&A is what we're calling it, which this is listener-submitted questions. You can submit it, email to George and Mick. We'll have their emails up a little bit later on. You can go to their Facebook pages as well. Let me go ahead and we'll run that across the screen here as well. Again, Slick Mick Old School Wrestling, George Shire Wrestling Time Machine. Also, want to tell you guys that we're available pretty much anywhere. Amazon, Apple Podcast, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, YouTube, obviously. So wherever you get your podcast, just go ahead and click subscribe, and you know, you can go ahead and get in on the fun here. George, what was the best from Steve Generelli? Hopefully, I'm pronouncing that right. What year was the best talent for the AWA?
You know, when I first got that question from Steve, it really kind of made me do some searching in my mind. And I realized that no matter what answer I give, it's going to be a personal opinion. If you're looking from a financial standpoint, the best years in the AWA was 1981, 82, and a little bit into 83. Those were the best money-making years. But I think Steve was considering the talent rosters. And as I have been through the whole AWA, I picked 1967. That year, if you go back and look at it, our talent roster, and I actually had to write them down here. We had Vern Gagne, of course. We had the Crusher. We had Dick the Bruiser. We had Danny Hodge, Lou Thesz, Johnny Valentine, Johnny Powers, Dr. X, Larry Hennig, Harley Race, the Alaskan, Rene Goulet, Doug Gilbert, Reggie Parks, Wilbur Snyder, Cowboy Bill Watts, Mad Dog Vachon, Mitsu Arakawa. And I'm probably leaving off some. That was the talent that was in the AWA that year. Phenomenal.
Wow.
I mean, some of them were here shorter than others, but when I looked back at the talent roster for one year, it was 1967 that anybody who was anybody in the business seemed to be right here in our backyard.
Question for you, Mick, from Mason Hoach. His dad told him about a tag team match involving Nick Bockwinkel and Ray Stevens in Minneapolis where a near riot broke out and an officer was stabbed. Can I tell us about that?
Yeah, that was kind of a unique situation. Nick and Ray wrestled Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch in Minneapolis. And at the time, both tag teams were heels. But on this particular evening, the fans were booing Nick and Ray. They were cheering for Dick and Dusty. And towards the end of the match, there was a lot of brawling going on, a big schmoz going on. And in the midst of it, a fan started to get into the ring. Referee Chuck Swenson, I believe, tossed the fan out of the ring. Everybody's in a melee. Nick and Ray and Dusty and Dick are kind of watching things as they're proceeding here. An off-duty officer who was named Bob O'Brien, Sergeant Bob O'Brien, was the chief security guy for the AWA at the time, actually intervened, and a fan took a knife to Bob O'Brien. Thank God it wasn't serious at all. Obviously, he could have gone for one of the wrestlers as well, but that was really as close as I think the AWA has ever come to a full-scale riot. The officer, again, it was minor injuries, but it was interesting that the fans would react that way, considering that Rhodes and Murdoch were heels up until that match. So, you know, again, it was an era, Chris, where everybody believed what they were seeing. And that, too, made the Minneapolis newspaper the next day.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up that particular match and that question of little consequence. That was the only Twin Cities wrestling card that I personally did not attend from 1968 up until the end of their run. Mm. And the reason I was not there, I was attending my fiance at the time, her cousin's wedding. And I have teased them all these years that it's a damn good thing they're still married, because I missed the only time that that tag team match took place in the Twin Cities. They wrestled in the rest of the AWA, but only one time here, and I never saw it. So I missed a lot, even with that story about the stabbing.
From Jerry Joy here for you, George. Who was the one wrestler who wasn't a regular in the AWA that you wish could have had a long program versus Nick Bockwinkel?
That wasn't a regular in the AWA. You know, there again, when I saw the question, I went, wow, this really scans the time. And I think the one wrestler, if I could have picked one guy to go against Nick in a program for a while, I came up with Johnny Valentine. Mm. Johnny Valentine was, by all accounts, as tough as they could be. And anyone who ever worked with him said that Johnny, he made you believe. And he even said that, you know, if you call wrestling fake, fine, but I'll prove to you it isn't. And he went in the ring with every opponent, and he was so good at making you believe. And after seeing him in 1967, and I actually saw him as a little kid in the 50s too, but he would be my guy. I'd have loved to have seen a program between him and Nick. And in that case, Johnny would have been the baby.
This is AWA Unleashed. It's a no Q&A, as you guys can tell on the bottom. If you've got a question, hit us up on Twitter at AWA Unleashed, Facebook as well. You can see at Mick Karch, Slick Mick, Old School Wrestling, or George Shire's Wrestling Time Machine. Got one more here for you, George, before I got another one for Mick. This one from Sean Castro said he remembers a match in Davenport, Iowa, that Blackjack Lanza unmasked Dr. X, and the announcer said he was Bob Marshall. And he wants to know, was that a different wrestler under the mask?
Well, first, let me correct Sean. It was not Bob Marshall, as he questioned it. It was Bruce Marshall. And the answer to your question is no, it was not a different wrestler under the mask. It was Dick Beyer. For some odd reason, when Beyer was unmasked in Davenport, also in Duluth and Winnipeg, he was unmasked by both Paul Diamond and Blackjack Lanza.
He was unmasked at all those locations?
And again, we didn't know this in kayfabe era. We had no way of finding this out, okay? So it was never acknowledged in any other city. But he was acknowledged or introduced as Bruce Marshall. And I talked with Dick about that. And it was a rib that they were doing on a local friend in Duluth. And they put Bruce and Marshall together, and that was his identity. And that's what he was given. When Dick wrote his book, Masked Decisions, he brings up those incidences in there about being called Bruce Marshall. And he never mentioned the St. Paul match where he took his own mask off and revealed himself as Dick Beyer. And he and I talked about that. And I told him, I said, you left it out in your book. And he said, you know, I had forgotten all about it. So that's something that's not in his book, but it did, you know, Mick knows it did happen here. He was Dick Beyer, the only place, but it was Bruce Marshall, same guy.
Here's a question for you, Mick, and I know this is something that we're going to cover in detail down the road, is WrestleRock. And this is from Jason Biagi. At the time of WrestleRock, Larry Zbyszko versus boxer Scott Ledoux was a hot feud, and you know we know Scott well in these parts. How did Ledoux make his way to the AWA? I was kind of wondering that, too.
I think Scott Ledoux was just one of those local celebrities that Vern kind of latched onto, got the rub a little bit from another sport. Ledoux was such a local hero. I believe it was Larry Holmes that he got into the ring with, and he gave such a great accounting of himself. There's a picture of the late Scott LeDoux. What a great guy he was. And Vern had actually, you know, tried this similar kind of thing also with benchwarmer Bob Lurtsema of the Minnesota Vikings. He brought Bob in as a referee and then got him involved in some angles and programs as well. So Vern liked to get that local tie-in, that local flavor, and Scott LeDoux was just picture perfect for that angle with Larry Zbyszko. And, you know, may I say, in that match, LeDoux hit Larry Zbyszko. God bless Larry. He took a shot to the jaw, and he did the backdrop and sold it like hell, but it was very believable, and it was a red-hot angle for a while. But it was just Vern, you know, attaching to the local sports community.
Was there ever any concern that Scott might go a little heavy because he was a professional boxer, or was it always just kind of a working punch? Or I mean, how was he received when he was coming from that side?
Oh, everybody was great with it. I mean, and they work with these guys pretty often before they give them the green light to go ahead and go in the ring. So, you know, like I say, Larry sold the punch like crazy. Maybe he didn't hit him as hard as it looked like he hit him. But, no, LeDoux knew what was going on, and basically, you know, and Lurtsema did too. They smartened the guys up really well before they would put them in front of a big crowd.
How long did benchwarmer Bob, I mean, how did he do in terms of being able to acclimate to the business?
Well, not very well. I think benchwarmer Bob was more of a comedic character than Scott LeDoux was. And that kind of, you know, was a transition, not even much of one from the character they gave him on TV. Last time I saw benchwarmer Bob, he had already worn out his welcome, you know, as a celebrity at the wrestling matches, and he was walking back from a match at the St. Paul Civic Center. I forget who he was wrestling, what the program was, but the fans started to boo him. And good old benchwarmer Bob from the Minnesota Vikings flipped off the fans. And, you know, so I started thinking to myself, you know what, Bob, maybe the wrestling business isn't for you. You know, if you're going to let a couple of boo birds get under your skin like that.
Did you want to say something, Joe? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you know, the name benchwarmer, that says it all. You know, he didn't really have that fantastic of a football career, but he was kind of a cult hero, and that benchwarmer Bob nickname hung in there. And so, you know, it was a couple paydays for him, but in the end, it wasn't the best fit.
Here's one for you, George, from Alan Jendrick. Were there any wrestlers that had legit heat outside the ring with other wrestlers?
Yeah, there were. A lot of wrestlers could have heat with another wrestler, but realize that they could make money in the ring. And so for whatever reason, they were professional enough to be able to step into the ring and put those differences beside outside that they have and make. And then, of course, the reality is their feud, their programs together looked so much more real. And I think the one that just has to come to mind is Larry Hennig and Vern Gagne. And I would throw my buddy Stan Kowalski in there with Vern Gagne. They both had legit heat with Vern outside the ring. They were not close. You're not going to see them attending a picnic together. But when they got in the ring, it was money, and they knew how to make it work. And so within the AWA, I think those are probably the two classic ones. The other thing is, and in our politically correct world, we don't really like to say this, but I will share one that there was one. Harley Race, he had issues with Sailor Art Thomas and Ernie Ladd. Harley mentioned a few times that he didn't want to be in the ring with them. And we'll just leave you read between the lines on that. But that was kind of a legit heat. But when they got in the ring, Harley wrestled Sailor Art a number of times in their matches. I mean, they were good. And you gave they gave you the impression that, you know, Harley didn't like him and Art wasn't happy with Harley. So I think those are things that, you know, Jandrick was asking. And AWA-wise, it'd be Hennig and Gagne for sure. And we could go into a whole program on that behind the scenes. And maybe someday we will. But they just plain didn't like each other.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. You know, as we continue to dive in, excuse me, a little bit deeper, we'll definitely take a deeper dive into that one. Got one here for you, Mick, from Diana Sundstrom. What was the story with Marty O'Neill making a blunder on TV about a preliminary match on a card with a Battle Royal main event?
It's going to be a Battle Royal in St. Paul, and the preliminary matches are going to be drawn from a hat on television. Draw one wrestler's name, then another wrestler's name, and those two guys would pair up against each other in one of the preliminary matches. So Marty has drawn names one at a time, boom, 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 and he's announced probably three, four matches, and he comes to the name Chris Taylor. And I believe Chris Taylor was going to be wrestling Andre the Giant that night. I don't remember who the opponent was. But Marty drew the name of Chris Taylor, and that was the only name he drew. Yep. And he said, and his opponent will be Andre the Giant. Well, Marty never drew that second name. So either Marty was clairvoyant, but there it was. The magic of television or the magic of Marty O'Neill, he knew he was Kreskin early in the day, and he announced Chris Taylor's opponent without having seen the name.
I remember that, and I just went, what?
I mean, why weren't things – I mean, that was obviously all just a work, but, I mean, how what was Vern's reaction to that? Like, how did everybody react to that, and how did they
Everybody loved Marty, first of all. Mm-hmm. And I don't know – I assume Vern was in the studio that day, so they probably joked about it, but I promise you, before they joked about it, Vern was doing this to his forehead. God damn it, Marty. How could you? They love Marty, so I'm sure all was forgiven after that. And this was on TV.
I'm going to go the other way, and I'm going to say Vern probably never even caught it. The match was going to be Andre against Taylor, which would, at that point would have been gigantic, no pun intended. And I don't think they ever noticed it. And maybe Marty never did either. But I remember he didn't pull Andre.
Here's one for you, George, from Lenny Balkin. Did the AWA ever sign wrestlers to contracts, or were they paid on a per card basis?
This is something you hear about a lot in wrestling. When the expansion started taking place in 84 and the invasions of the territories, contracts became the big thing. To say that a wrestler, any wrestler in any era, did not have a contract would be absurd. Because there always had to be some agreement to work for the promotion and for the promotion to have you work for us. So, yes, there were contracts, but they weren't in the sense where everything, all the I's were dotted and all the T's were crossed. It was a lot of handshake and a lot on without paper. As far as the salaries or the payouts, a wrestler knew what he was going to make in the territory for the most part. But a lot of times it was dependent on particular gates at certain matches, what their percentage was going to be to the gate or where they were on the card. And they were always given more of a, this is what you could make, this is what you will make. But genuine contracts on paper were not prevalent. Put your mic on, Chris.
Here we go. See? Perfect. Live podcasting.
Six-figure salary, and you can't turn your mic on.
And he's making more than us. Now, can you figure this, Card? Oh, yeah.
I'll show you my. See, this is my salary. Right there.
Oh. Good.
Yeah. Good deal. Yours is coming direct deposit, guys.
Yeah.
Just want to tell you guys that if you guys do have a question, you can see on the bottom, rate, review, subscribe, wherever you get your podcast. because we're having a lot of fun doing this. And again, if you got questions, head over to Facebook on Slick Mix Old School Wrestling, George Shire's Wrestling Time Machine. And we've also got trivia coming up. Just want to go ahead and kind of reset everything. Where you can find us on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Google, Amazon, you know, just YouTube, wherever. Just kind of want to continue to get those plugs out there and keep giving us that feedback, because it's been absolutely awesome. Let's go to you here, Mick, because we got a few more for each of you here. This one coming from Robin Scott. What happened to Chris Markoff?
Oh, boy.
Chris Markoff,
the ever-tormented Chris Markoff. Chris is actually doing quite well. The last time I saw Chris was at a Hall of Fame induction, Minnesota Hall of Fame induction ceremony. That's where the picture was taken. Stan Kowalski was being honored. Chris lives in Minnesota in the summertime and the spring, and actually owns some apartment buildings. So financially, he does real well. He's smart enough to go south for the winter, Florida. Chris, of course, was the third Dolly sister. There was Larry Hennig, Harley Race, and Sweet Lips Christine. Those were the names that the Crusher gave the Dolly sisters. And I always joke about this with George. First of all, Chris, when he started here as Chris Markoff, he built himself out of Yugoslavia. Then all of a sudden, one day, he's aligned with Boris Zhukov, and he's moved to Russia. But one of the great things about Chris, you could listen to a Chris Markoff interview from 1966, and then you could listen to another one from, you know, 1987, and just change the names. The interview was exactly the same. But what Chris used to say in his thick accent, he would warn everybody. He would warn the Americans. Giorgio vouched for this. He would say, "The Russians is coming." And then in the next breath, he would say, "They are here." So my question is, are the Russians coming? Are they here? Or did they take this supersonic flight? And in that split second that he gave us the warning they were on the way, they've landed on our shores. I love Chris Markoff. I mean, he doesn't get the accolades he deserves. He's an old school pro through and through, and George and I had a lot of interaction with Chris, and just a great guy.
One of the things about Chris that I always loved when he was billed out of Yugoslavia, and he had a feud going with the Crusher in 1966, Markoff had Professor Druck, Steve Druck, as his manager. But Chris would come out, and again, I can't do the accent like Mick did, but he would tell us the accolades of his body. And he would say, "Crusher, I got a 26 inches the arm, 27 inches the chest." And we were waiting for him to go down the anatomy and come in whatever inches. And it was classic Chris Markoff. So he was quite the deal. He had a great run with the Crusher. Man, but 26 inches, and then we're saying, "Please don't go down any farther, Chris."
That's enough. Ring the bell.
He came into the AWA and worked under a couple of different names before he was Chris Markoff. So we'll talk about that at another time.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, guys, coming up next week, we're going to talk about enhancement talent.
So yes.
That'll be a lot of fun just to talk about the guys that, you know, you look back and you really appreciate what they did. You're like, damn, though. I mean, without having the jobbers or the enhancement talent, the stars don't get the shine, and I'm glad that we're going to be getting into that, because those performers definitely deserve their rub here. A few more before we go ahead and wrap it up from Cheryl Heron. This is for you, George. Were Mad Dog and Butcher real brothers, and were there any other brothers that wrestled here?
Yes, Mad Dog and Butcher were real brothers. In pro wrestling, that was a rarity, because it seemed anybody that looked alike or even wrestled alike could be brothers in pro wrestling. We did have another set of real brothers that were in the AWA later on in the 70s. But before that, no, Mad Dog and Butcher were the only real brothers. But we had the Kalmakoff brothers here. We had the Nielsen brothers here. And going even earlier in the Minneapolis territory, we had the Brunettis and the Lasowskis. None of them were brothers. So Mad Dog and Butcher, real life brothers. They had a fictional brother that worked with them, Mad Dog and Butcher. And that was Eric Pomeroy, who was a Canadian wrestler who worked under many names. And he wrestled as Stan Vachon in the South with Butcher and Mad Dog sometimes.
I'm just blown away by the fact that there's, you know, in wrestling, there are not real brothers. I'm sick to my stomach. I just can't get over all the stuff that I'm learning about the business today.
You know, the one thing that I thought was always interesting about the brothers is when Gene and Lars, I mean, Mick, you're trying to insinuate something here, and you shouldn't do that. When Gene and Lars Anderson,
la 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 la.
When Gene and Lars Anderson were in the South, Vern would never acknowledge that they were brothers. He always would refer to him as Lars Anderson, but never mention Gene. In fact, some of the pictures that the AWA posted of Lars Anderson had Lars Hainimi under them. So he divorced him from Gene. And most AWA fans would tell you that if we could have had a set of fictional brothers come here, it would have been Gene and Lars, and later Gene and Ole. They would have fit in so great, but they made their money down South.
We've got about 10 minutes here, guys. From Douglas Oswald, this is for you, Mick. You mentioned Paul Pershman a few times, and he was a friend of yours. How would you rate his tag team with Doug Summers?
I thought they were great. In the scheme of things, I think their matches that they had with the Midnight Rockers, they were all bloodbaths. And the problem was twofold. Number one, the AWA was just beginning its downward slant. There's Paul, of course, on the left, and Doug Summers on the right, Buddy Rose and Doug Summers. The AWA was just, in about 1985, 86, was just starting to, you know, tilt down the other side of the hill a little bit. And the other issue was that Doug Summers, in all the time that he had been wrestling in the AWA, he was more or less a mid-card enhancement guy. And because of that, I don't think people necessarily took Rose and Summers as seriously as they should have. But they were phenomenal. And I will tell you that Paul Pershman, Buddy Rose, was a ring general for all his 217 pounds and the whole gimmick that was. He was a great technician, and he would have been the first to tell you, in all their title defenses, he never lost a fall. It was always Doug Summers that put the opponents over in the match. And, you know, Doug did so willingly. But again, in the scheme of things, it's too bad. You know, you hear about all the big-name stars in AWA tag team history. Rose and Summers, to me, were as good as it got.
Go ahead, George.
I would just say that a lot of people don't know. We've talked of Harley Race. Doug Summers received a lot of his very early training from Harley Race. And that picture you showed of Rose and Summers, if you looked at it closely, that was the American Wrestling Alliance mistake belt that they were wearing that followed on from the Road Warriors. I picked it up when you put it on here. So it says Alliance, not Association.
All right, let's get one more each here. I know we've got more questions, but we'll do more of these. From Jim Puke, this is for you, George. Why didn't Vern Gagne have a title versus title match against, you know, Bruno or Funk or Briscoe or even Harley Race?
Well, I think what you have to first realize is that from the 60s on up until the mid-80s, pro wrestling territories never acknowledged that another territory even existed, much less another world championship. A lot of times, if you listen to All-Star Wrestling, you never even heard the words American Wrestling Alliance or Association. They didn't broadcast that part of it. It was just the world champion. Got into the 70s and the name started to go, the AWA name. But for that very reason, having a title versus title match in the kayfabe era just wasn't going to happen because, number one, they weren't going to acknowledge another champion or even put over another guy's, another territory's champion. And the promoters just wouldn't do it. It was enticing because the magazines, the newsstand magazines, would tout it as being something, you know, that fans would want to see Bruno against Vern or.
Oh, I mean, it would be huge thing for just the casual fan.
And even Vern, he come out in Wrestling Monthly number one in 1971. And he stated that he wanted to have a series of matches with the two other champions. But before that, it never happened. Then as you got into the 80s, you started having some of these Flair versus Bockwinkel or Bockwinkel versus Black Flint and things like that. Yeah. But they weren't going to acknowledge another group. And they didn't need to because they were drawing well with their talent. And fans didn't know the other side.
All right. And last question here, guys. And again, if you guys have questions, just continue to submit them. We're going to do several of these, maybe every, you know, five or six episodes or so, depending on what people might want. Last one here. Speaking of enhancement talent that we're going to do the show on next week, this one for you, Mick, from Misty Green. Back in the 70s, a wrestler named Torpedo Guzman was hitting on her after the matches in Minneapolis. She wanted nothing to do with him. Not that she really cares, but whatever happened to him?
Torpedo Guzman, who also wrestled, I believe, as Blackie Guzman here on TV once in a while. He was one of those guys. He would come in from Chicago and that area, and he would come in with Angel Rivera, and he would come in with Tom DeMarco and guys like this. You know, they'd come in for their $50, $100 and go home. I don't know whatever happened to Torpedo Guzman. Misty, I'm kind of like you. I don't really care whatever happened to him. But it's
you didn't want anything to do with him either? Was he hitting on you too?
I didn't care for the guy at all. I just plain didn't like him. But one thing I would say is a great lead-in for our show next week about the enhancement guys. And I mentioned before, one time I asked the readers of my page, submit some names of the enhancement guys. Hundreds.
Yes.
Hundreds of names. So we're going to have fun with it. No doubt.
Yeah. And I just feel like it's one of those that, yeah, you're right. I mean, people, I think the older we get, the more we look back, we're like, God, those people were fun. I mean, you really understand how much they meant to the overall picture. Whereas, again, the stars don't look nearly as good without having the solid enhancement people to work with. All right, guys, as we're getting ready to bring it home here, I know that we've got a shout out that George is going to give. Also, in terms of trivia, we gave the trivia question, the answer earlier on to the Bobby Heenan question, which was Eric Martin knew that the last man that Bobby Heenan managed before going to the WWF is Harley Race. What is this week's question, guys? And I'll ask you, Mick, but then is it cool? Because I already put it down on the screen, so it's going to have to be that people can email George as well if they've got the answer to this. Is that sound okay to you guys? I guess I didn't approve it, but I just said, screw it. I'm just going to do it.
For me, you better ask, the professor.
Well, it's funny you even asked that because I have had people emailing me texting me and giving me the answer. So either way works.
Yeah.
Mick is the one that's parting with his valued collection. So I don't care who wins it.
All right, Mick. So let's go ahead and give today's trivia question.
Okay, trivia question. I'm kind of paraphrasing, doing it from memory here. George
lost
to Wrestling Brothers, legitimate brothers in the AWA. In the 1970s, there were two brothers that wrestled in the AWA, and they were also professional football players in the NFL. So tell me who those two guys were, and let me know by February 3rd. And if you win, I will go into the deep treasured vaults of wrestling memorabilia, and I will find you a picture of Jose Quintaro or, you know, somebody like that, or, you know, we'll come up with something. Sky Lolo's, Trunks, or whatever. We'll get you a nice prize.
Oh, wow. Are these are ring-used Trunks, right? I'm sure.
Don't worry about that.
Don't
worry about ring-used Trunks. Don't worry about Chris Markoff's dimensions. Don't worry about Shire burying all the wrestling fans. Don't worry about any of them. Have a good time.
I figure it all works together, you know, ring used trunks, you know, lower dimensions. It just, it all fits together.
George Shire, absolutely.
Oh, all right, George, speaking of you, we're going to give you the last word. Last week, we started the shout out. Mick gave one out to Brandon Deck. You, my friend, have the final word with this week's shout out.
I want to acknowledge this week's fan and friend, my buddy Al Nichols. Al, you have been one of the most fun people to talk with about pro wrestling. You've got a great memory of many things that happened. I love when you share your stories, and you're a great asset to old school fans. So Al Nichols, love you, buddy. Keep listening, and we appreciate everybody that listens. Every fan, even those of you that only write with a crayon, you're still our buddies. We love you.
Shit, I can't believe we're going to end on that note.